All right, this I always think of this as the real opening night, the first true League Pass extravaganza of the season. Before we get started, though, I want to tell you about BetQL. If you want an edge over Vegas, download BetQL, the app you need to get an advantage this season. Discover value bets, line movement, find out what bets the public backs with BetQL. The best part, it is free to download from your mobile device. Head to betql.co, that's .co.com, and use promo code CAPSPACE for your free 3-day trial. Give yourself an advantage over Vegas and download BetQL, that's betql.co, and that familiar promo code CAPSPACE. So I think we should start with the game that we did for the Twitter NBA show, Danny. Dallas and Phoenix, a ballyhooed matchup between Luka Doncic and DeAndre Ayton. Probably fair to say that Ayton got the better of this one. Had a very nice offensive performance, especially early on. What I liked the most about him was he wasn't really trying to do too much on the way to his 18 points on 8 for 11. He also had 6 assists, remarkably, although I'm not sure how many of those were value-added plays. A lot of it was Kokoschkov's offense, as the Suns racked up 35 assists, which this is one of the worst passing teams in the NBA the last few years, so that's just an incredible number for them under Kokoschkov's system. And I thought that Ayton did well to just take what was there. They didn't do that many straight post-ups for him against guys his size, which is where he's not fantastic. He hit a couple of turn-and-face jumpers, which we know he's capable of hitting, on DeAndre Jordan, who I didn't think had a good defensive game, especially in the first half. And then he got two quick buckets by just getting a switch and posting up hard right at the charge circle, getting a pass and scoring. Hit one nice lefty hook against a mismatch on Wes Matthews, and finished around the rim reasonably well. So again, it was one of those things where he didn't do anything that was like, oh man, that was just so impressive, but the dude is big and he scored very efficiently in this game.
I think the best way that I can describe this game is that it was a matter of perspective, and this is very hard when talking about the Phoenix Suns, because there are a group of people that have a very specific perspective on certain members of the Phoenix Suns, and there are those that do not. And for those who, like, for the positive side of it, there were absolutely things to grab onto for all of the major figures in this game. Devin Booker had a wonderful offensive game overall. He had that huge stretch from about the 5-minute mark to the 2.5-minute mark where he scored 12 points and basically put the game away. And that was on 3 threes and a nice and one where he got a drive, got enough space. And I think it was on Dennis Smith. I can't remember which Maverick it was on. And offensively, Booker did that. And I thought Brunson was the guy he blew past.
Brunson,
he
had that and one. Then he had, the Mavs just couldn't find anyone to stop him, in part due to their own problems. Like Dennis Smith, they put him on Booker one possession and Smith just turned his head. Booker did a cut off of a big and just hit a three over him. He hit another just incredibly difficult three on the left wing as the shot clock expired. It was really just an incredible performance, and he's certainly capable of just being totally unstoppable at times. But I liked the overall efficiency that he brought, not only just in terms of going 12 of 19 from the field for 35 points and 6 of 10 from three. I like that he took half of his shots from three. Getting up 10 three-point attempts is awesome. 7 assists was also really good, but I just like the fact that they didn't,
and he didn't turn the ball over. That's one of the things I want to focus on.
He had 3 turnovers, and, but it nothing bad for that.
But that's for having the ball in his hands as much as he did. I'm never going to really quibble with 3 turnovers.
Real quickly, you mentioned the ball in his hands. I thought actually what was so impressive about in the 35 assists was he got his points and he got them efficiently, but it wasn't just him dominating the ball every time. It was those Utah principles where they move the ball, they're able to set him up for plays where really for the first time he was having guys get him the ball in positions where he could just finish the play instead of having to create it. And I thought that was certainly a reason for optimism in Phoenix, although against what should be a bad Mavs defense this year.
Especially without Harrison Barnes being there. Dorian Finney-Smith did a lot. Wes Matthews, to me, he's looking older kind of by the day. Not the same guy he was at 25. And that's okay. It happens to just about everybody. He's an expiring contract at this point. But I think, of all the people who had their moments in this game, I think the person who demonstrated the most value was actually Igor Kokoschkov, because this is not a dramatically different, the Suns have different personnel like Trevor Reason, Ryan Anderson, but those are not guys who a team takes their character from. Like, this is still a Devin Booker team to me. And their offense looked completely different. This was a much more competent team.
Yeah, I mean having the spacing, encouraged... though, I mean, having a three and a four man who are actually going to make shots is just... And obviously, you know, they're replacing some of the worst coaches in the league with between Triano and Watson last year. So,
I don't mean to discount that. Some of it is parsing credit.
But I agree.
It's parsing credit.
For the long term, like, Anderson and Ariza aren't going to be a part of this team. Kokoschkov, the hope is, will be.
Yeah, and they can get other guys who can fill those roles differently, but ably. And another element of that, I thought TJ Warren actually taking threes. I mean, I don't think he's going to go 3-for-4 every night. I mean, for obvious reasons.
And neither is Josh Jackson. I mean, 6 out of 8 for those guys. And then Ariza was 5 out of 9. I mean, yeah, they're 19 to 34 from three. They're not going to get that, obviously, every night. I mean, those guys, if they can get a combined 33% out of those guys this season, that would be great.
Sure. And that boosts up the assist numbers and all that kind of stuff. But the offense looked, from a process standpoint, I thought it looked much better than it has in previous years. And one of the points that I think you and I have both made with Devin Booker over time is that I wanted to see what he can do when he doesn't have to manufacture as much of his offense. And I think that was closer to it. There were certainly moments, especially in that 12-point run, where it was a lot of Devin Booker doing really well. And I also want to note, because it's important, it's another facet of the game, that both, to me, Booker and Ayton were bad defensively. I thought Booker was awful and Ayton was bad. I think that's probably a fair way to put it. And you can build a very good team. You can even do a great team if your most talented players are not good defenders. And both of those guys, I'm not closing the book on them forever or anything like that, but the concerns about them defensively were really laid bare in this game. I mean, Devin Booker wasn't given a tough assignment with Wes Matthews and was just straight up losing him on cuts that didn't really have anything going on.
And most DeAndre telling Ayton, too, is when the opposing coach is drawing up every after timeout play to specifically attack Booker, that's when you know that there's an issue, because the opposing coach, he's the one who knows, especially when that man is Rick Carlisle. I mean, and what about Ayton?
Well, so Ayton, I think my biggest concern with him is recognition, because there were plays where he wasn't really doing anything and something came in, which would be a center responsibility. I mean, whether we're talking a good defensive center like Joel Embiid or Rudy Gobert, or we're talking even a shaky one, at least those guys generally know what's going on. And there were plays where a guy's, you know, driving towards the basket, Ayton's not even mixing it up with DeAndre Jordan and just never gets over there. It's not like Jordan's walling him off or anything like that. He's just not there. And that led into one of my big concerns with Ayton, which is not necessarily that his intentions are bad, but that his instincts aren't good. And those are harder to correct, because yes, it's true that the accountability has not been there for him. Hillcrest Academy, you know, Arizona ran this weird pack line defense last year that put him in strange positions.
He was also playing the four for them most of the time.
Yeah, he was also playing the four a lot of times for them. But you kind of, it's a lot of it is just kind of that basketball IQ element of it. And there was a lot to like about it, and his comfort with his jump shot. You know, he did do some nice jobs getting into the right space on offense. But we've had this discussion, you know, Carl Anthony Towns, another guy who's in this conversation. I think Towns has more defensive talent than Ayton does. And Nikola Jokic is in this conversation too, about how good, like, what do you do with a center who's way better offensively than they are defensively? And Ayton, you know, it's way too early to make that definitive statement now, but you start to have those thoughts, and it's kind of where the NBA is going, where do they fit in, and Ayton can be a very useful player without it, but it's a lot harder.
Yeah, and I think, you know, he, and to a lesser extent, Bagley, who actually didn't really play much at all tonight, but he is going to be a very polarizing player, as Devin Booker is going to be, right? His box score stats are going to be pretty good. I mean, he put up his 8-for-11, he had 18 points. I mean, so when you do that, it's tough to necessarily be a negative player, but I think other teams will defend him a little bit better, and that, you know, the things that he's not doing. And of course, I mean, every time I tweet out like actual video evidence, this is what I love, right? Like, this is what we've come to now, where when you tweet out, first of all, you could say, oh, his defense is bad. And people are like, no, it's not. And then you tweet out actual video evidence of his defense being bad, as we did throughout the broadcast. And Suns fans are like, oh, like, this is just three plays, or you just have an agenda. I'm like, it's right there on the fucking film. I didn't draw this in a sketchbook. It's right right there. So, yeah, and in the same tweet, it's, yeah, he had an excellent offensive game. And it's like, oh, why are you shitting all over? I'm like, I said he had an excellent offensive game. It's like, you can't be even-handed anymore. And it's all... It's ridiculous.
Yeah, and
this
gets into something else that I think it's good to put this out there at least once at the beginning of the season. You and I don't have agendas with this. We will talk about players that have flaws and all that kind of stuff. It is not because we want the Suns to fail or we want DeAndre Ayton to fail. It's just these are our opinions on DeAndre Ayton. It's the same thing with all those Lakers guys. And I'm, you know, if they the way I like to do this, and it's funny, I've tried to articulate this a lot of times, is praise when warranted and criticism when warranted. That's what I do. It's not, if a guy gets better, I will talk about it. Victor Oladipo, I ripped on Victor Oladipo for years on this podcast and in my writing. He got way better. I praised him for getting way better. That's the way this works. And if you want somebody who will praise the guys that you care about when they don't deserve it, there are many places that you can look for that content. This is not that place. And I have, like, for me, it's important to build a reputation as somebody who will tell the truth as I see it. And if you disagree with that, that's totally fine. But there is no benefit for me to distort what I feel because of some sort of other benefit.
Well, let's talk about the Mavs now. 10 out of 33, that was even with a late flurry. From downtown, they really struggled. Dennis Smith, pretty atrocious game, 6 out of 19, just was getting into the mid-range, getting into floater range, just could not convert. He only played 28 minutes. The Mavs really trailed by 10 most of the game after a really ugly first quarter in which the Suns were 6 out of 10 from downtown. And then they got back into it, I think got within two with about 5 minutes left before that massive Booker flurry. I think the Suns had like 25 points in the last 4 minutes or so of the fourth quarter, led by Booker and some great three-point shooting by Josh Jackson as well. But they came back into it with kind of the old guard, that second unit that did well, Kleba and Powell at power forward, J.J. Barea, Jalen Brunson actually took some of Devin Harris's minutes as well. And then they just had Wes Matthews out there with those guys. And then when they went back to the Suns pushed it up to 7, Carlisle finally went back to the starters, and then they started getting lit up again, and they just had no answers for Booker. They tried everyone on him, and he was lighting them up. Doncic started off well, went 0 for 5 from downtown, including airballing a wide open spot up 3. I think all 4 of his 5 attempts were off the dribble, tough step backs. Wasn't able to make any of those, although a few of them were close. He also had 4 turnovers. It was not a good debut for him. 4 assists. We saw early on, he looked great, 6 points on 3 of 5 in the first quarter, and then really kind of faded. And I think that's something we're going to see a lot from him. He is not in, despite dominating in the EuroLeague, the NBA is a 48-minute game. The schedule is extremely difficult. He's not really in NBA shape from a body composition standpoint, certainly, and perhaps from just, not even necessarily a cardio standpoint, but just, you know, being able to make it through the whole game. So I think we may see him fade down the end of games. This is a reason why I wasn't that high on the Mavs. You know, Doncic and Smith went 11 out of 35 today. And yeah, those guys are prospects that I like, but they're also rookies. And those are the two primary offensive creators. So I think they'll look better when Harrison Barnes comes back to take a little bit of the pressure off those guys and also add one more shooter. What do you have on the Mavs aside from that?
DeAndre Jordan's defense was awful for most of this game.
He finally brought it at the end.
That is a big problem.
Like the fourth quarter, started, but he just like, he doesn't really move and he doesn't really jump that much. You know, he's capable, but just his activity level is so low at this point. He was always spottier than people thought, but it really, these last couple of years, it's been ugly.
Yeah, like he would have some of those plays as a Clipper where he kind of fly through the play and then you realize, and it looked good, and then the guy would just finish after he went by, those sorts of plays. There were fewer of those. There were plays where he kind of looked like he kind of saw what was going on, but just never really got over there. And playing, it could end up being that playing on a less competitive team, if that's where this season goes for Dallas, could end up making him look even worse, just because if his energy level waxes and wanes. And then this was a rough game for Dennis Smith. I think that's another important takeaway. This was a duality we talked about during the offseason, during the preview podcast, is Dennis Smith was one of the most distressed destructive players in the NBA last year. And that was not a surprise. Both of us were high on him as a, like, in terms of where he could end up being. And there was very little last season that dissuaded us from that opinion. But it takes a lot to get from there. And there were moments where defensively he, I blame Eric Bledsoe for this because Eric Bledsoe does it too much. But he helped without really helping. And then his guy was wide open. They hit his guy and got a three. I think there was one where he kind of tagged Ayton when his guy was Ariza, and Ariza just drills in above the break three because he wasn't there to contest it. And then Smith, there are parallels here with a couple other guys, one of them incidentally being Josh Jackson, where like when his game looks good, you see those pitches, like his speed with the ball when he gets a little bit of a seam and makes it a big seam and just gets by guys. Every once in a while he makes a nice, like, kind of puts his hand out there, gets a steal and gets a dunk. But the question is always going to be with Smith, what is the proportion of those flashes versus the proportion of the fizzles? And my belief, because I believe in his physical potential, is that the proportion will get better with time. But what I think what today was a reminder of is that even if it improves from where it was last year, there's still a lot more room to grow.
Yeah, and Ben tracked the possessions that Doncic initiated, basically where he was the one creating the action, and pretty ugly. 10 points on 15 possessions on those plays. Smith, even worse. 13 points on 23 possessions for him. And Smith, you know, this doesn't count like full court, right? I think Smith had three fast break dunks or layups, some of which were created by him. But in the half court, his efficiency was really just awful. The shot selection was not great. He hit one step back three-pointer, and then he went to, oh, I'm hot, you know, when you hit your first shot of the game, and then just takes a terrible three on the move, not even set the next time down, that like barely hits rim. Tough game for him. I really liked what I saw from Maxi Kleba off the bench. 2 of 2 from downtown. Just a very aware defender, switchable, not someone that you ever really heard about coming out of Europe. But he is a great find for the Mavs with his athleticism. He can get up for some alley-oops as well. Powell was very efficient, 16 points in 17 minutes. He's an excellent role man. Jalen Brunson playing 19 minutes. Another reason, I didn't think he was horrible. He hit one tough three, but he turned down a lot of threes also. And defensively, he was a little too slow. He got cooked a few times. But, you know, he's playing over Devin Harris. Devin Harris, you know, is at an age where he could be done. JJ Barea at least looks like he still has it this year. He had 10 assists in 21 minutes. But hopefully with Barnes's return, Brunson wants to play because, again, they have no wings off the bench. Well, I thought Dorian Finney-Smith played pretty well today. 2 of 5 from three, looked confident. Taking it where, you know, the three-pointer had been a limitation in his game before, but you can get 12 points in 30 minutes out of him. That's actually like very, very good. So there are some reasons for optimism for the Mavs, and if the Suns shoot a normal percentage from three and the Mavs shoot a normal percentage from three, this is a close game. I didn't feel that the Suns just like so crazily outplayed the Mavs, other than just Smith and Doncic just struggling a little bit, but in particular Smith. So that's about all I got on this game. Anything you wanted to add still?
No, I think that's it. I mean, Josh Jackson put together a nice stat line, 7 for 11 from the field. So 18 points on 12 shooting possessions. And it was nice to see him. He had two big corner threes where the Mavs just left him wide open after the Booker flurry. And it was great to see him make those. But overall, his shot selection was the same thing that I had problems with before. Some of those shots went in today. We'll see if they go in at a higher proportion for this season in its entirety. Then maybe I'll feel a little bit differently about Josh Jackson. But and he had a nice defensive play where he got a chase down block on Dennis Smith, which actually led to a Smith foul, and Smith got pissed off and pushed him. But and also no Mikal Bridges. I don't know if there's a larger story to that, but yeah. You know, like we'll have to see how all those Suns guys fit. I like that the system looked better under Kokoschkov. Booker had a really nice night offensively. Ayton showed a lot of the positive, like the people who support him, like kind of why they feel that way. And also you mentioned it briefly, but I mean they cut Shaq Harrison. Isaiah Cannon started in the place that I thought Shaq Harrison was gonna get, and you know Cannon wasn't a great scoring night for him, but I thought he did a nice job distributing. It was still weird for me that Dallas was treating him more as a driver than a shooter, but I thought he had a solid game, better than I expected.
I mean, if you look at this starting lineup, they are putting Ayton and Booker, but in particular Ayton, in position to succeed. I mean, Ayton played 36 minutes and he's the starting lineup is the two starters at the front court for the Houston and Rockets at the start of last year, Anderson and Ariza, both the three-point shooters. Cannon can't really do anything except take three-pointers. He was 2 out of 5. And so they just have enough spacing around these guys. Now, when they they go, and I made the point before about the Suns offseason that they can make lineups that work at times. Now, defensively, better teams than the Mavs, I don't think the Mavs are going to be a great offensive team this year. You know, better teams than the Mavs are going to cook these guys for sure. I mean, between Cannon, Booker, and Ayton and Anderson, I mean, that's like four really bad defenders in your starting lineup. So, and when they get Jackson and Warren out there together, when those guys aren't going 6-8 from three, the spacing's not going to be as good for sure. No Dragan Bender in this game, by the way. No Rashawn Holmes in this game. Elia Kobo did get 8 minutes as a backup point guard off the bench in the second half. I think they basically just ran Booker as the backup point guard. And again, he was outstanding. And I think, you know, it'd be very interesting to watch his progress because he's been overrated as far as his performance already, but he took a big step forward last year. And if he could do that again, especially under Kokoshkov, and if he's being set up in these positions again, you know, Dallas is not a team that had anybody to stop him, so let's not go crazy here, but maybe he could be like, oh yeah, you know what, that max contract was a good idea. Well, probably wouldn't have been still because they cost themselves a bunch of cap space and they could have just given it to him next summer, but nonetheless. So last thing I want to talk about too, Dallas talking about how they're going to run a lot more. Very slow pace to this game, only 93 possessions here. I don't have the and 10 fast break points for the Mavs. That's not amazing. I don't have the exact possession stats available right now, but let's move on to telling you about Danny's employer, The Athletic. Obviously, you can get all of Danny's work there, including his every player stuff for the Warriors in their app. He's wrote a preview of all 30 teams. They also have exclusive video content now, the Gordon Hayward's exclusive 5-part series in concert with the Players Tribune, detailing his comeback, which has certainly been a difficult one. The setback of his second surgery, was something that really I hadn't known as much about. And I also wanted to highlight one of their new writers, someone you probably haven't heard of, a guy named Kelly Eco out of Houston. He's joined The Athletic this year. I read today his preview on the Rocket season. There's just like, Kelly is really good. Like he understands the game. He understands analytics, but you know, where he really shines is just as a reporter. And you always get a couple of nuggets out of his, you know, whether it's exclusive interviews, whether it's source reporting. You know, there's a few things like Marquise Chris didn't come into camp in great shape for the Rockets this year. Like that's something that I didn't know that I learned from reading his preview. He also mentioned that the chatter about Trevor Ariza maybe getting bought out and rejoining the Rockets is something that actually, you know, there might be some truth behind that. So I always learn something when I read Kelly's stuff, I recommend following him on Twitter as well. He's the type of guy that The Athletic has really worked hard. They've got all 30 teams now that they are covering, so even if you're not a fan of a certain team, if something big happens, you can go on to The Athletic and find out from the local guy. And then they've got great Shams is with them now, Sam Amick. I mean, they really just have so much firepower, and then obviously Danny's stuff as well, which you're probably a disloyal listener if you're not an Athletic subscriber already, frankly. I really am impressed with some of the talent that they were able to find, and Kelly is a great example of that. Where do you want to go next here, Danny?
Let's go to San Antonio. I mean, this was the kind of the drama center of the day because of the Jimmy Butler stuff. This was his first game with the team after making the trade demand and all the practice ridiculousness and everything like that. And I cracked up because at the beginning of the game, you turned to me and you said, didn't San Antonio beat Minnesota on the first day last year? And we kind of were a little bit ambivalent about Minnesota. And I'm like, that sounds possible, but I didn't know for sure. And sure enough, the Wednesday of the season last year, San Antonio beat them, I think it was by 7, and Minnesota ended up beating Utah in their next game. But I think an important element to consider with this game, because while Minnesota is probably high in people's minds here because of the Jimmy Butler and all that stuff, one of the big questions for me this season is whether San Antonio can still defend. And I'm not, even though they had a good night, they won 112-108, I'm not totally sure we have an answer to that question, because Minnesota is just tailor-made for San Antonio to still defend well.
Yeah, with the lack of spacing, the two bigs as well. A couple of interesting notes from this one. I didn't watch this one quite closely enough. I mean, I think we're going to just kind of bounce around a little bit, just keep you up to date on what happened, even if we didn't watch a game necessarily incredibly closely, or if we saw some snippets of it. But unfortunately for Minnesota, in a lot of ways, they picked up right where they left off against the Rockets last year, with Karl Anthony Towns fouling out in 22 minutes and only getting 6 field goal attempts. But he played most of the first half, and he only had 3 field goal attempts at halftime, and But don't worry, Derrick Rose got plenty of field goal attempts in 31 minutes. He took double the number of Karl Anthony Towns on his way to 3 for 12. And don't worry, Jimmy Butler got plenty of shot attempts up, 9 out of 23 in 32 minutes for him. Interesting that he only played the 32 minutes.
Here for fun, do you want to guess how many corner threes Minnesota attempted in this game?
Well, considering that they don't exactly emphasize it and that San Antonio was the first team in the league really to try to take those away, I'm going to guess one.
It was three. They made one, but still, I mean, that's pretty remarkable. They didn't take a single one from the left corner. They were all from the right corner. I believe I saw Wiggins take and miss one, but I mean, Minnesota, we talked about this a fair portion last year where there are moments in time where you sit there and go, God, their offense is so frustrating and terrible and all that. But then they ended up finishing the season in the top 10, you know, because they have so much talent. And that gets into this weird realm with them where it's like, it feels like they could be so much better offensively than they are. And we'll see if that continues for this year. They were able to put it together when Jimmy Butler was healthy last year.
I don't think they can. They just don't have enough spacing. They don't have enough system. They got too many inefficient guys.
And they have a coach who I don't think is creative enough to use the unique strengths of his best offensive player.
Well, and especially when that guy is your only decent three-point shooter on the roster, basically, other than Tolliver.
But I think even if you gave Tibbs a roster that was more well-suited to Karl Anthony Towns, when I watch that team play, I don't think, oh, there's this untapped, like, he's really trying stuff and it's being screwed by their spacing.
And you'd think, oh, he's such this old school coach. He would love to just throw the ball into the post every time to Karl Anthony Towns, but, you know, that's we'll see what that looks like once Butler is gone. Glenn Taylor had an interview. The Wolves broadcast was basically brought to you by Pravda. They start off with this montage, and you know, this isn't coming from the actual announcers themselves, who are really good, but there's clearly, you know, an edict, because this is a local, all these local teams are, you know, either owned by or basically business partners with the teams themselves. Of, oh, you know, like, here are some of the lines that they had on just this, like, intro. Oh, because there's all this turmoil, but the Wolves' future is secured. And they show, like, the montage of Andrew Wiggins and Karl Anthony Towns. Basically totally glossing over the Butler thing. And no matter how much turmoil, you can always say that, like, with the Wolves' young talent, they'll always be all eyes north. It's just this. So there was the start. And then at halftime, Glenn Taylor did an interview.
You missed the best part, though, where they referred to Derrick Rose as a league MVP.
Oh, yeah. They re-signed a league MVP, and it shows him with, like, his one dunk of the season. Like, it was, and then on the broadcast, you know, like, Jim Peterson, who is, I guess I will say he's been maybe more honest than some local telecast would want their color guy to be. It had some stat about how, you know, the Wolves really struggled. I think he was talking about how, like, you know, they just hadn't had much continuity when they're talking about, like, the best Wolves players' records on opening night. And his partner was like, oh, no, we're trying to be positive. And then Jim has to, like, spit out these positive stats. Like, it was very clear that someone had told them, all right, you guys got to be positive here. All right, that's not stuff on the court, but I think it's interesting, especially because there's all this concern over, like, the business and stuff. I'm very interested to see what the reception is that Jimmy Butler is going to get for his first home game over the weekend.
Well, something we should talk about that was intriguing for me from this game, I'm not going to say important yet, was I thought Jeff Teague played really well, and he was getting to the basket, got to the free throw line for 9 attempts. And so there's the positive side of that Jeff Teague looked good. He was active and all that. Then you were also reminded of one of the biggest differences for San Antonio this year versus last year is beyond replacing Kyle Anderson and Danny Green, all these guys, is also DeJounte Murray being out for the year with the torn ACL. I mean, he did such a great job of blunting the point of attack, especially once he took over as the starter midway through last year. And Bryn Forbes, Patty Mills as a combination are not going to do a lot of that. And so it will be harder for San Antonio's defense to hold stout. I mean, it was ridiculous. Minnesota shot 49% in the restricted area in this game. And I mean, if San Antonio can do that every game, then they'll be totally fine. But we'll kind of see how they defend a couple of different teams. But I was happy for Jeff Teague that he did so well.
Yeah, he looked good getting in the lane. He had the floater working. For San Antonio, Aldridge actually played 42 minutes in this game. It was only 7 out of 23 from the field, but he had 8 offensive rebounds. Jakob Poeltl started, but only played 8 minutes and had 4 offensive rebounds in that time. San Antonio racked up 19 offensive rebounds. The Wolves had 14, but that was 37% offensive rebounds for San Antonio. And this was actually an offensive game. San Antonio had a 119 offensive rating in this game, and Minnesota had 113. DeRozan looked pretty good in his first game as a Spur. 28 points. He played 38 minutes on 26 shooting possessions. So not amazing, but they certainly need someone to soak up these possessions. And, you know, to give up that type of an offensive rating to this San Antonio team is not very good. And for Minnesota, who plays two bigs all the time, to give up those kind of offensive rebounds is not great either. Let's move on to New Orleans and Houston now. New Orleans did claim Tim Frazier off of waivers, former point guard. They need a little bit more depth at that position. As you've noted, they don't really have an established actual point guard backup. They've got Frank Jackson, who wasn't in the rotation tonight. But New Orleans just came out and absolutely just kicked the shit out of the Rockets. And the number one thing that I took away was just how badly New Orleans abused that Rocket switching. Julius Randle just was an absolute terror, including going 2 of 4 on three-pointers. He and Aaron Baines can battle each other for the most uncomfortable looking three-point form among big guys that actually goes in, surprisingly. But Randle, 25 points on only 18 shooting possessions. I'm sorry, no, that it's 17 because he had a couple of and ones. 3 assists, 8 rebounds. Anthony Davis had a career-high 8 assists. By halfway through the third quarter, he was plus 26. He only had 10. I'm sorry, no, that was, I was looking at the wrong line there. AD had a lot more than 10 points. He had 32 points. He looked fantastic in the post. He scored one-on-one, even on Clint Capella. You know, he hasn't really shown the ability to just score with his back to the basket against centers. He was moving guys around a lot too. He mentioned in a piece with Brian Windhorst that he had worked on his lower body, just accepting that he had to play center. And he was moving these Rockets guys around on switches. Nikola Mirotic was on fire. He was 6 of 8 from downtown. He had 30 points in this one. But the Pels overall were only 10 out of 25 from downtown. That's not a crazy number, but they just busted their asses on switches. Then Elfrid Payton, he had the Thon Maker, should we call it the Thon Maker triple-double? Oh, wait, no, it wasn't 10 fouls. It was actually a normal points, rebounds, assists, triple-double. But 10, 10, and 10, exactly.
Yeah, it's funny. I always think of Jason Kidd with this, but technically Andre Iguodala has done it more. Iguodala is the only guy who's ever done it more than once. And
You're talking about exactly 10 points, 10 rebounds.
Exactly 10, 10, yeah. And 10. Yeah. And so, yeah, I thought this was an inspiring game from New Orleans. One broader point that I want to make is that I've been skeptical of Anthony Davis's MVP candidacy just because it's so hard for a player who doesn't run the offense to just get enough touches. And if AD is going to do it, it's going to be with games like this because he was impactful defensively. I thought he did a nice job. He absolutely stuffed Clint Capella on one play where it was, you know, they were both in position. Yeah. Capella tried to go up and Anthony Davis just said, no,
sir. He set the tone defensively
absolutely.
That first quarter where Houston really was struggling to score around the rim. He was fantastic.
Yeah. And so you have a lot of these positives from New Orleans. I mean, I picked them to go over. I believe I picked 48 wins for them. And I like so much of what they can do. And a lot of that was manifest in this game. 29 of 37 in the restricted area, and both parts of that are huge. I mean, 78% is bonkers, and getting 37 attempts, and they still got to the line 22 times in this game, so that's really impressive. And Houston, there are a couple of different things that I think are worth discussing with them, and one of the big questions for them this whole season is going to be, they were the most successful isolation basketball team in the history of the NBA last year. And James Harden, Chris Paul, still awesome ISO players. Like, they had better fundamentals there than almost everybody, but those shots are going to have to go in. Defensively, not only did they change personnel, but they also lost Jeff Bozelic, and so that's a factor in here as well. And so the Rockets will play a lot better than they did in this game, but this is really all about May and June for them. And one of my big concerns from this game is that two of their more high profile additions really did not look like May and June players.
You're talking about Michael Carter-Williams as a high-profile addition?
I mean, they didn't add that many guys. I mean, so their additions, Ennis, Melo, MCW, because Gerald Green doesn't count as an addition. He's not added. He's retained. Am I missing somebody?
Yeah. No, I mean, Melo, negative 20, 3 out of 10 from the field, 1 of 5 from downtown. And
and Julius Randle beasting him a post-up. Julius Randle was enthralling.
Julius Randle beasted their entire team. And really, like, we talked about this, how Randle could be a really good addition for a playoff team, because we saw this with the Lakers. Like, he is not switchable. Like, he is one of the few guys. I mean, I'm not sure that there are many other guys in the entire league I would rather have just going in an ISO against a mismatch, because he's a good enough ball handler that you can just throw in the ball and he can just bully guys facing up. Even if he has a bigger guy on him, especially if he's going to shoot the ball like this now, if he's got a bigger guy on him, he's fast enough, he's still strong enough to go through a lot of guys. And there's just not many guys you look at who are like, oh, this guy is a good matchup one-on-one for Randle. Now, he can switch defensively, but he's not fantastic defensively. And his shooting range, you know, I'll believe this three-point shooting when I see it, 2 months from now. But man, I mean, like, and he's a beast getting position as well. Like, the guy's, like, really quick, and he's 250, and he is just, and 250 might be light, frankly. Like, anyone who's not a center on him, like, he's just abusing them in the post. Like, James Harden, a pretty good post defender. No, like, he got just knocked backwards. Like, Chris Paul can switch onto a lot of guys. He can't switch onto Julius Randle, Michael Carter Williams, Carmelo. I mean, no, even though Carmelo's got some heft to him these days, just a really impressive. And I think the Lakers are really, I understand he wasn't a great fit and they felt like they needed some perimeter talent, but man, like, Randle is a great talent. And people say, oh, well, you know, the Lakers, Aaron Mintz hated the Lakers, he wasn't going to stay there, and you know, Randle, like, they couldn't sign him to a long-term contract because they needed more space for next year, because they already it was clear they weren't getting anyone in this year, and they could have retained him with that cap hold and paid him anywhere up to the max. And so my solution was, hey, just pay him 20 million, offer him a one-year $20 million deal to stick around with the hope that maybe it'll work out again next year, as opposed to, I mean, he left for the Pelicans for $18 million in guaranteed money over 2 years with a player option on the second year. So he clearly, no matter how much he hit it, he would have stayed there. And the guy is just a talent, man. Like, he is really, like, you just don't let someone like that just leave. And so, I mean, it's amazing how, you know, every Lakers fan is like, oh man, Julius Randle, he's so good, he's one of our great young players. And then as soon as the team lets him leave, it's like, oh yeah, it totally makes sense that we let him leave to get 1 year of Rondo and Lance Stevenson.
Yeah. And incidentally, I mean, you know, the other big beneficiary there of that whole move was that, I mean, Randle was probably going to provide more value this year than Rajon Rondo. And I mean, while it's still, I mean, Elfrid Payton did get his 10-10-10 in this game, and we'll still see that. But I mean, Randle's an interesting piece. And also, we should mention, big game from Nikola Mirotic.
Yeah, I did. I mentioned beyond him briefly,
Oh, you did? Okay, because did you mention his 7 offensive rebounds?
No.
But one thing that I noted in this game,
14 offensive boards. I mean, that's got to be like the most they've ever had in the Elfrid Gentry era. But yeah, Mirotic was like, he was crashing hard.
Yeah, and that's something I wanted to talk about, was that he also was going after 50-50 balls, and there are risks, of course, with power forwards in particular going after loose balls, just because if they don't get it, then they're going to be behind the play, and Mirotic can hustle, but he's not always going to get back. But I thought he did a really nice job in this game, and they have enough other defensive talent to make it work. And so I still want to see what New Orleans is going to get from their other bench players. I mean, Randle was obviously great, but Miller and Hill, you know, not particularly inspiring games from either of them. Not that they got an amazing opportunity there, but the bones of the New Orleans team are really, really good, and I like so many of their players. And I think Gentry already showed that he has the intellectual desire to maximize Julius Randle, which is great, and that's not a surprise. I mean, as soon as they signed him, it's like, oh, it's gonna be so fun to see Gentry and Davis and all this kind of stuff with Julius Randle. So I'm excited for that. I'm not putting too much into Houston getting their butts kicked in this game, especially because we watched bits and pieces of this game. It was actually an original primary during its time slot, but once we kind of figured out where it was going, you're like, okay, we'll have plenty of chances to watch the Houston Rockets. But you know, we'll have to see there, and whether they can get more from some of their bench guys. I mean, Eric Gordon, again, obviously great, but what they can get from the other guys. And most teams aren't going to be able to exploit their foibles nearly as well. This is kind of the parallel with the Boston Philly game yesterday, where they happen to face a team that knows how to attack what they do and has good personnel personnel for it. But, you know, that didn't happen a whole heck of a lot to Houston last year. New Orleans did beat them. That was the first game they lost with Chris Paul, James Harden, and Clint Capella all playing together, was that game with DeMarcus Cousins getting hurt, tearing his Achilles. But still, you know, it's a data point, and I don't think it's an important data point yet, but it is a data point.
Well, I'll tell you what, though. Michael Carter-Williams cannot play on this team. I mean, he did actually hit a three late.
If he gets a lane in transition and just has the ball in his hands, he could do something. But a lot of NBA players can do that. And all the rest of the time, he's a negative.
Somehow he was actually plus three, but he ruins the entire offensive system. Like, just him not getting guarded. Like, there was one play that really stuck in my mind where Harden blew past his man. It was at the end of the quarter, I think, and Carter Williams was in the corner, and I think it was Elfrid Payton who was guarding him, and Elfrid Payton was just standing at the dotted line while Carter Williams was in the corner, and Harden saw Payton and had to slow up, and then he ended up getting stripped by the guy from behind because he had to slow up, and Harden was like, oh, that's Carter Williams. Like, you know, if it's Trevor Ariza in that corner, Harden just throws it to him, and he hits a three. You know, but he knew it was Carter Williams. Carter Williams had like missed a couple of threes really badly. He hit one in garbage time, I believe. But yeah, it's he was maybe the worst rotation player in the NBA, and then he was injured. So this idea, and they got to have, he's the only backup point guard they have right now. And Chris Paul, you know, he played 32 minutes tonight. Like, he shouldn't be playing more than that. So I mean, they got to get some production there. You know, they can get onto the buyout market. This team may not be the same. Harden, it was definitely a real struggle for them. He had a few buckets late, but you know, only 18 points for him, 10 assists, 6 out of 15. Clint Capella didn't play well. He got completely stuffed, as you mentioned, a couple of times by Davis early on, and that seemed to get into his head a little bit. James Ennis looked okay, but yeah, I mean, the defense is the bigger problem. I mean, and you know, right now, healthy, I mean, they got one guy maybe that you trust coming off the bench. Joe Green had a rough game here too, but the defense was just so awful in this game. And the Pels, I mean, the Pels earned that though. I mean, they were beasting inside, and I really liked the offensive rebounding. And so, the number one thing I'm looking at this year is, what are teams' plans for beating switches? Everyone knows the Rockets are going to switch even more than the Warriors ever did now. So many more teams are switching. Who's going to come out here with a plan to beat that? And the Pels had a great plan tonight. Their post guys won, and then they ran like absolute crazy and got a lot of threes in transition, and they just lit up the Rockets. You want to talk a little bit of Bucks Hornets here before we go?
Yeah, let's do it. So, I mean, you and I watched more of the first half than the second half, and that's when the Bucks went absolutely crazy. They were 11 of 22 on threes as they dropped 67 points in the first half, which is actually fewer than New Orleans had. I think New Orleans had 71 or 72 at halftime. And that toned down a lot in the second half. They were only 3 of 12 on threes. But we saw a lot of the kind of the positive elements of Milwaukee in terms of just having more floor spacing. Brooke Lopez having a step back three, which was just earth shattering in certain ways early in the game. I thought Giannis had some nice stretches, even though his shot wasn't going early in the game. He missed a couple finishes around the rim, still put together, you know, it didn't feel like a great Giannis game, but he had 25, 18, 8, and 8 turnovers. So you can kind of go with that. But one thing that I think was two things actually that were interesting takeaways from this game. One, Charlotte going super small at a couple big moments, including part of their fourth quarter run, playing Kemba Walker, Malik Monk, and Tony Parker together. And the Bucks, when they started stagnating late, going to Chris Middleton for buckets, and largely Chris Middleton doing well.
Yeah, the switching was really kind of what got Charlotte back into it, right? How did they avoid giving up as many three-pointers? 22 in the first half, 12 attempts only in the second half, was they started switching everything again. And that did kind of stagnate the Bucks offense. At least they're playing with more spacing now, though. So when they were going one-on-one, it looked better than it did last year. That MKG at center lineup did get the Hornets back into it. Also, getting the Hornets back into it was 7 points in the last 1 second of the second and third quarter. They hit buzzer beating threes, and one of them was an and one in each of those quarters. And then Kemba Walker also went crazy. The Bucks were playing with the big back, you know, that's the coverage that everyone had been wanting for a long time, but Kemba Walker, he really got on fire and killed it. He was hitting some difficult attempts. I mean, I didn't think he was being defended poorly most of the time by Eric Bledsoe, but you know, he was on his back, and Walker still, they're setting the screen high enough that Walker could get separation and pull up from three. He finished 7 of 13 from downtown, 15 18-29 overall and dropped 41 points. Also was able to get into the lane. Some interesting rotational stuff for both teams. Miles Bridges didn't play much, only 15 minutes, 0-for-1. It's always interesting when, oh man, this rookie had a great preseason, and then you look down and he's not really playing that much. Parker, you mentioned, actually had a decent game. He was 4 out of 8. Monk hit a big three-pointer late. He had 18 points, 34 minutes from Malik Monk. That's actually very encouraging. Nick Batum continues to look really ugly offensively. 2 out of 8, although he was out there late playing as the power forward next to MKG as they made the run back for the Bucks. Ersan Ilyasova got a lot of the minutes at backup center in the second half. Christian Wood did play for five minutes. He was 1 of 1 from three. They also gave John Henson 12 minutes at center. The backup wing situation was probably the most interesting. Dante DiVincenzo, 22 minutes, got the most minutes of any Bucks backup perimeter player. The Bucks also did not play any normal backup point guard. They just kind of put the ball in the hands of either Brogdon or Giannis. Playing with some of those other guys. DiVincenzo actually impressed. You know, we didn't really get to see anything of him in summer league with that groin injury. He had one nightmare game, but he was bombing, taking some pretty difficult threes. He even got brought out there as a defensive replacement. And, you know, for him to play 22 minutes, Tony Snell only 11 minutes. Dele didn't play at all. Pat Connaughton didn't play at all. So, I mean, Mike Budenholzer, you know, may have asked them to draft DiVincenzo, but he's playing him and he looked good in this game. If he keeps shooting, I mean, these like difficult three pointers and hustling, you know, that's going to look like a pretty good pick. And we'll see whether he stays in the rotation for a long time ahead of those guys or not. I had a few notes on the end of the game here, but anything else that you took away from the meat of this one?
Well, I want to bring up with DiVincenzo, it's the combination of confident shooting and just going with it, because he was 2 for 4, but you have to respect it if it goes in at least a reasonable amount, because it, quick release when the opportunity presents itself, because then you have to close out on him. Maybe you don't stray as far away from him, and then that creates more real estate for Giannis. I mean, you could see some of the potential in this team, especially offensively, with Lopez just helping space the floor. But even there was this funny play where we were trying to I couldn't figure out who was standing in the corner, but it was John Henson. And because you're just sitting there going, well, under Jason Kidd and Joe Prunty, there's no way that a center like John Henson would ever be in the corner. And, you know, it just pulls the center out a little bit, gives more real estate for guys to work with. And I think the rotation is a work in progress for Milwaukee, but a lot of it's there. I thought there were some nice moments for Eric Bledsoe. Still imperfect. I mentioned it in the context of Dennis Smith. There are still a couple plays where he helped for no good reason, and then his guy got wide open for, again, no good reason. But offensively, I think Budenholzer, God, now I'm getting the spoonerism is hurting me, that'll really help him offensively. He will be a big beneficiary of this change, and so I'm excited to see it. But also a good game. I mean, Kemba was phenomenal in this game, and we should underline, bold that and everything else, because he was amazing. One of the best players on the real opening night of the NBA. And also, when Charlotte went to a center late in this game, they did not go to Cody Zeller. They went to Hernan Gomez. And I like Hernan Gomez a lot, but I did not expect that.
Yeah, it was interesting. They had that small lineup that was switching, and about 3 minutes left, they had a few possessions where they couldn't score, including some key missed free throws late as well. And so they went back to Willie, I think just to boost the offense. And he was pretty solid. He had 9 points in 12 minutes. And he did have a tip in during that period. But I have to question both coaches. Borrego, the biggest one to me, was on the key play of the game with it tied down the end, 40 seconds left, he leaves Hernan Gomez in the game. They're switching. They get him onto Giannis, and he follows Giannis on a drive. I mean, they were shooting free throws. They could have gotten Hernan Gomez out of the game. The Bucks had a chance to get a 2-for-1 there, but had already used up one of their two timeouts, really for no good reason. It was just like after Charlotte was shooting free throws, and they just felt like they needed to call it or something. So they couldn't advance the ball and get the 2-for-1. They failed to get the 2-for-1 there. Budenholzer did actually show some growth from his Hawks days. Giannis, they're up still pretty good early in the fourth. Giannis gets his fifth foul on a pass and crash, which was miserable, and has to go out of the game. They come back and tie it, and he actually brought Giannis back in with 6 minutes left, so he wasn't too conservative about that, and Giannis ended up, you know, helping them win the game. You know, do they win if they don't bring him back that early, and he didn't foul out? You know, that was definitely pretty useful. Then Budenholzer went with John Henson as the defensive replacement. They were in conventional pick and roll defense on the end, and that's with Kemba Walker. Walker got into the lane. I thought he had a very good look against Henson, and maybe you could say Henson bothered him, but it didn't look like he did that much. Walker did miss it, but you would have liked to have someone in a last shot situation who could have maybe switched, you know, bring in a Tony Snell. They actually even brought in DiVincenzo as a defensive replacement. And then Marvin Williams got the offensive rebound, tipped it out, but Batum missed a wide open three-pointer with the Hornets down one that could have won the game. Anything else on this one?
Well, I feel decently about the idea that the Hornets can be a playoff contender if the, you know, depending on how the bottom of the East shakes out. I thought they looked pretty good overall in this game, and Borrego opening up their offense a little bit more is encouraging. You know, they might not hit 16 to 30 in threes every night, but maybe they'll make a couple more free throws, and they have talent on this team. I thought Lamb looked solid. I thought he would play more, but Malik Monk had a nice scoring night. So it was really nice to see. That's something we've talked about. Just guys who it looks like maybe they've disappointed early in their career, but maybe there are mitigating factors that are worth considering. And Monk missing so much of both of his first two summers due to injury probably really hurt his development. And hopefully he can use this year as a springboard to bigger and better things.
All right. I want to just talk a little bit about some of these other games, which we didn't get a chance to watch a ton of, but since it's opening night, you know, at least give a few nuggets. Utah 123, Sacramento 117. But most notable here for Sacramento, Marvin Bagley did not start. Neither did Harry Giles. It seemed like that was going to be the starting front court. But au contraire, Bagley only played 12 minutes. Giles only played 10. Instead, they started Cauley Stein, who was awesome, 23 points. And Bielitsa actually started at the four. They started a two-point guard backcourt with Yogi Ferrell and De'Aaron Fox, and then Buddy Hield at the three, which, you know, against Utah, they don't have, you know, a three who you really have to guard, so you can get away with Hield at the three. Guard in the sense that, you know, in a one-on-one matchup. And so Cauley Stein, we've seen him be effective before as the role man when they actually space the floor, but, you know, so little of Cauley Stein's career has actually been spent playing with any kind of a stretch four whatsoever. And so Bielitsa was really effective. He had 18 points in this game. I'm looking forward to going back and watching it a little bit more. But the Kings actually scored quite well against the Jazz. They were good in transition as well. Still only got up 19 three-point attempts. The Jazz take away a lot of those. And it was a crazy high pace, though, which was a big part of this. For the Jazz, Joe Ingles looks like he's not going to miss a beat this year. He had 22 points. Donovan Mitchell, 24 points, but it took him 21 shots to get there.
Oh, something else funny with this game was that Sacramento absolutely dominated the beginning of both halves. They went up 9-0, and then they were down 15 at halftime, and then they came back and actually took the lead relatively early in the third quarter. And that shows in the plus minuses. Their starters were all positive, and then their backups just got worked by the Jazz. And I mean, it makes sense. Not only are the Jazz a deep team, but they play some of these mixed lineups, and they have a lot of talent. So I'm happy that we didn't get to watch any of this game that Sacramento had some real positive signs. I'm happy
to be clear,
Shumpert,
you're not happy that we didn't get to watch them. You're happy dash even though we didn't get to watch any of this game.
No, I'm happy that
upset any sensitive Kings fans.
No, and I also Amon Shumpert playing 18 minutes. I mean, again, I'll want to see him actually play, but after having such a lost season due to injury, if he can put some things together in his last year on this current contract, it'd be good for him.
Memphis got completely destroyed in, was that at Indiana or at Memphis? I thought it was at Memphis.
It was in Indiana.
But nonetheless, killed. We could be quick with this one, but
what you mean? You mean their 80.7 offensive rating?
Oof. Especially the offense looked so ugly. The one portion of this I saw is when Shelvin Mack was running the show as the backup point guard, but Garrett Temple started, Chandler Parsons started, Wayne Seldon barely played, Dylan Brooks barely played either. Marshawn Brooks, though, had played 22 minutes, although they were getting blown out here. Kyle Anderson didn't start either. I have a feeling that not a lot is going to make sense for the Grizzlies this year with JB Bickerstaff as coach, and if it does make sense, it'll immediately change to not making sense again. And for the Pacers, Miles Turner just got $72 million. He played 20 minutes, and Domantas Sabonis, who might be better than him, played 29 minutes and was more effective. Nate McMillan did say basically that we're not going to see Turner and Sabonis together much, that those guys are both essentially centers, which is a good sign. TJ Leaf had to leave with a sprained ankle. Tyreke Evans was plus 23 in a revenge game. And then Yeah.
Oh, a slight correction. Memphis's offensive rating was slightly better than I said. That was an incomplete game. They were all the way up to 87.4 in the full game.
Oh, thank God.
Probably because of garbage time. I'm assuming that's what the difference was.
And Toronto with a successful start to the Kawhi Leonard era, although he had 24 and 12, but it was only 9 out of 22 from the field. I'm looking forward to going in and watching, see how he looked. He did play 37 minutes, though, in this one.
And we can mention when we're going to see them, because that will be the Twitter NBA show on Friday. We're going to do a second one this week because we're really excited about Celtics Raptors.
And Kevin Love was 5 of 18 from the field in this one. Colin Sexton, 18 minutes. You know, again, another rookie not playing a ton. They started George Hill and Rodney Hood. Really, nobody appeared to have played particularly well for the Cavs, who lost by 12. And I think that will do it for today. Thanks so much for listening.
Yeah. Can we briefly mention Boban just for?
I did want to note. Yeah, that's right. I was missing that from our list. Yeah, go ahead.
So Denver ended up winning the game 107-98, but only because Boban only played 18 minutes, plus 7, 18 points, 6 of 8 from the field, 6 of 6 from the line, 8 rebounds, and one dunk where he basically didn't leave his feet, which is just fantastic. And it was good to see Denver pull this game out. This is the type of game that they lost a few of last year that cost them a playoff berth, where they had, you know, pretty good handle on it in the third quarter, but just never ended it. They, you know, they never swept the leg, and they didn't do that in this one either, but they got a few shots late, got a few stops late, and were able to win.
Yeah, the Clippers actually led 92-84. We did watch the last 5 minutes of this one, and basically scored 3 points in the last 5 minutes. Again, they hit a garbage three once it was already out of control as the Nuggets went on a run. The Clips are switching everything late. They went with Harrell at center down the end, and they were forcing the Nuggets into tough shots, but the Nuggets were making those shots. They took out Boban after Jokic hit a pick and pop three on him to beat the shot clock buzzer. Just some interesting minutes totals here. Shea Gilgeous-Alexander, 28 minutes off the bench. That was actually the most, tied with Avery Bradley for the most of any Clippers guard. Lou Williams had 24 minutes, 14 points, and nobody really played extremely well offensively for the Nuggets. Will Barton was probably the best of those with 19 points. Trey Lyles, 19 minutes. Miles Plumlee being paid $41 million to get 13 minutes. Although he did have a key block as a defensive replacement late.
Well, the big thing Denver did offensively was get to the free throw line.
Yeah.
33 of 42 from the free throw line. So like Jokic, he was 6 of 13 from the field, but he got 21 points on 18 shooting possessions anyway because of his 8 for 10 from the line.
Yeah, and Pat Beverly really struggled offensively, 0 for 8, but did appear to be his pesky self on defense. And now we are done. So catch us tomorrow. We'll do some of those games tomorrow. We have some other features as well. And also, I'm going to tweet this out so you can just respond to the tweet. But we're doing a new feature for 15 and 60. There's not really enough games yet to get into our usual statistical analysis. So we're on the Eastern Conference, we're going to do one mailbag question about each team. So hopefully, I already did this once and got some good questions, but want to make sure we have one for each team. So that's what Sunday night's format is going to be. So please tweet me at Nate Duncan NBA. I will be tweeting that out in a little bit here, probably for tomorrow morning or something. So please look for that at a time when I'm not tweeting so often. You'll actually be able to find it. All right. Talk to y'all tomorrow. Till then.